From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On this President's Day, we focus on two presidents. First, Gary Wills talks about President Lincoln and the impact of his Gettysburg Address. Wills is the author of books about Lincoln, Kennedy, Nixon, and Reagan. Then we examine the contributions and contradictions of Thomas Jefferson. We'll hear from Joseph Ellis, who won a National Book Award last year, for his character study of Jefferson. Ellis says the best and worst of American history are tangled together in Jefferson. For example, he wrote that all men are created equal, yet he owned slaves. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this President's Day, we're going to look back to one of the most important and influential presidential speeches in American history, Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. If Lincoln's speech has been reduced to a cliché in your mind, stick around and listen to Gary Wills read and interpret it. In his book, Lincoln at Gettysburg, Wills described the address as words that remade America. Wills is also the author of critical studies of Presidents Kennedy, Nixon, and Reagan. The interview we're going to hear was recorded in 1992, after the publication of his book Lincoln at Gettysburg. The Gettysburg Address was delivered at the dedication of the battlefield cemetery where thousands of soldiers fell after one of the bloodiest battles of the Civil War, the Battle of Gettysburg, in 1863.
The battles ended on July 3rd, and on July 4th, people woke up, and this little village of 2,000-some people found 8,000 dead bodies in their fields and gardens and farms, and six or so dead bodies of horses and mules. So just covering them up at first was a tremendous problem. Then after they had done that, pretty much hugger-mugger wherever they lay, people started coming from Union states, families, delegations from the states, trying to reclaim the bodies and take them back for honorable burial. But nobody knew where their contingents were, where individuals were, so they were rummaging around, turning up bodies almost at random. This presented such a health hazard that the Pennsylvania authorities said, no, you can't take the bodies away. And they set up an interstate commission to finance and govern a new cemetery. But they couldn't start moving the bodies until the first frost came, which means that as they tried to identify them, they had been lying in the ground for 3 months at the outset, and for 9 months by the time they finally finished up. It was very hard to identify bodies. They had to take the southerners away. They had to find out what state each northern body came from. They had to do ghastly things like try to sort out separated body parts according to the proper trunk. So it was a very grisly thing, and only 2,000 or less, about a third of the cemetery was filled when Lincoln came there. They hadn't been able to beat the freeze of the ground, and so they had to continue in the spring. So it was all very unfinished. There was no monument. Lincoln could not speak in the obvious place because people would have been treading on these fresh graves. So he had to speak higher up the hill. So it was a time for healing, and that's why the local representative, David Wills, had appointed Edward Everett, the great orator, to come and give his customary two-hour speech, which was very popular. He drew a tremendous crowd. If he had not been there, 15,000 people would not have heard Lincoln speak, because Lincoln didn't have that drawing power.
How do you think Lincoln saw his mission with the Gettysburg Address?
Well, he knew about these cemetery dedications. They were big cultural events in his time, and he had been to at least one that we know of in Springfield. Getting people out into nature was a transcendentalist cause in the mid-19th century. They wanted to get away from the churchyards and go out into nature where people would come and meditate on death. They loved these liminal experiences of crossing barriers between life and death, sleep and awake, etc. So these cemeteries were considered schools of learning. In fact, children were deputed to go and take care of them so that they could contemplate death from an early age. And he knew that. He had consulted the man who laid out the cemetery, William Sanders, who told him that he had carefully plotted it so that there was no hierarchical order, no precedence of officers over men or this state over that state. So lying in the ground, they enacted, as it were, the idea that all men are created equal. Lincoln had invited him to the executive mansion to discuss this, the rationale. It was part of his preparation. He had clearly prepared very carefully, not waiting to scribble on the train or wherever at the last minute.
You know, I'm sure I'm not alone in being one of the many students who had to memorize some or all of the Gettysburg Address. I can't remember how much I had to memorize. All I remember is 4 score and 7 years ago, which I kind of remembered as 4 score and 20 years ago. I didn't even get that right. And so it was really interesting for me to go through your book and to reread the address and realize, wow, it really is beautifully written. I never, ever noticed that in all the times that I've had to read the address, to tell you the truth. And I never really thought of it as colloquial either. But you've put it in historical context in the book and show how this really was incredibly colloquial for its time, for oratory.
Well, I wouldn't exactly call it colloquial. It was brief, certainly. It was pregnant. It was not flowery. There are very few overt images. But the language is actually quite Latinate. You know, he says things like conceived in liberty, not born in freedom, dedicated to the proposition, not sworn to a truth, etc. And it's very abstract. He doesn't mention particulars. He never even mentions Gettysburg. He doesn't mention the North or the South or slavery or the Union. It's astonishing what he does not mention. He talks about this in an almost scientific way, that this is an experiment in freedom. We're finding out here whether this nation or any nation so conceived and so dedicated, anything in that category, can long endure. And if we prove that the experiment is survivable, then liberty shall not perish from the earth. So, as opposed to Everett, who went into tremendous detail about the battle and excoriated the South for invading this peaceful valley and that kind of thing, Lincoln, as usual, talks above North and South of a great national mission that's being worked out in the war. And of course, that's why he wanted to go there so badly. He was trying to redefine the mission of the nation in the midst of war so that they would come out of these horrendous scenes, these bloody battles, the beginning of modern warfare, really, with all of the technology of death, with a new birth, as he calls it, of freedom, that we went back to our origins and realized that we hadn't lived up to the proposition that all men are created equal. We'd had slavery, we'd had these other things. But now we have to continue the effort that the fathers dedicated us to when they brought this nation out of the continent in a kind of virgin birth at the beginning.
How does the language of the Gettysburg Address compare with the typical oratory of the time?
Well, as I say, it's less flowery. For one thing, it's brief. He realized that the attention span was getting shorter. He and Mark Twain came to this realization at about the same time.
Hey, and this was before television.
Absolutely. But it was the time of the telegraph, of steam, of the railroad. The pace of life had picked up. And, of course, Lincoln was tremendously aware of that because he was at the center of the telegraphic communiques from all the battlefields with all of his generals. He used to go across to the War Office, right across from the Executive Mansion then, and spend hours sending and receiving telegrams. And he was very upset at officials and generals and engineers and others who would send him these verbose things where he's waiting for the message and they go on for sentence after sentence after sentence. He's not finding what he wants to hear. He liked Grant because Grant had tremendous economy of language too. Grant proved to be a very good writer after the war. But he had this sense that life was picking up. So in the address, he rarely uses and or but or that kind of thing. He uses ascendaton, as the rhetoricians say. It's we cannot dedicate, we cannot hallow, we cannot consecrate. These staccato phrases coming at you, government of the people, by the people, for the people. It's not government of the people and, or government of the people, by the people, and for the people. He drops all of those things. So there's a tremendous leanness and tautness to the address.
I think this would be a good time for me to ask you to read the Gettysburg Address. And I think a lot of our listeners will hear it differently than they've heard it before. And let me reintroduce you. My guest is Gary Wills, and his book is about the Gettysburg Address. It's called Lincoln at Gettysburg, The Words That Remade America. And what do you say? You want to give it a go?
Okay. 67 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation, or any nation, so conceived and so dedicated, can long endure. We are met on a great battlefield of that war. We have come to dedicate a portion of that field as a final resting place for those who here gave their lives that that nation might live. It is altogether fitting and proper that we should do this, but in a larger sense, we cannot dedicate. We cannot consecrate. We cannot hallow this ground. The brave men, living and dead, who struggled here have consecrated it far above our poor power to add or detract. The world will little note nor long remember what we say here, but it can never forget what they did here. It is for us, the living, rather, to be dedicated here to the unfinished work which they who fought here have thus far so nobly advanced. It is rather for us to be here dedicated to the great task remaining before us, that from these honored dead we take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion, that we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth.
You describe the Gettysburg Address as having revolutionized the revolution and as having changed the way people thought about the Constitution. How?
Well, it culminated a long campaign that he had undertaken in the late 1850s to get away from the problem posed by a Constitution that recognized slavery. He said we have to look back to the Declaration of Independence, which pledged us to the proposition that all men are created equal, and treat the Constitution as a first attempt at achieving that ideal, which still has to be worked on. The ideal remains, though the embodiment and various forms of government can and should change. This was an elaborate trap that he had laid for Stephen Douglas in his debates with him. He kept saying over and over in various ways, oh, you want to get rid of the Declaration of Independence? And he said, well, no, I don't really want to do that, because, of course, it was a sacred symbol by then. And he said, well, what do you make of that clause about all men being created equal? Or what do you make of the idea that we are one people? Because Jefferson began by saying, when in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the bonds which tie them to another people. He was going against the idea that the Constitution was merely a compact between sovereign states. So all of this is concentrated in the tremendous prominence he gives to the Declaration in the Gettysburg Address. You notice he begins 67 years ago, which takes us back to 1776. If he had wanted to take us back to 1789 in the Constitution, he would have had to say 66 years ago our country was brought forth. And when he ends up saying government of the people, that had become a fighting phrase for him, because the Southerners and their supporters in the North, and Stephen Douglas in particular, had said, we are not one people. We are a collection of different peoples, different states, each of them actually or potentially sovereign, who can resume their sovereignty at will. Now, Lincoln had some warrant for this in various legal doctrines, but it was not the preeminent view. He made it that in the course of his long campaign in this. His first inaugural address spells it out in great detail. But all of that is implicit in the Gettysburg Address. And because the address became so rapidly a touchstone of what the war was all about, he made people think of the country as dedicated to equality and as single in its peopleness, so that up until the time of the war, everybody always used the United States as a plural noun. The United States are a government by contract or whatever. From the time the war ended, everybody uniformly used it as a singular noun. The United States is a government of regular procedures.
We'll be back with Gary Wills after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Gary Wills, is the author of Lincoln at Gettysburg.
Let me tell you something I'm not sure of. It seems to me today people are almost consciously trying not to be subtle in their public oratory because they're afraid people won't get it. And I'm wondering if you think that the thousands of people who were assembled to hear Lincoln got all the kinds of subtleties that you're talking about now.
No, I don't think most of them got it at the first go.
Well, it wasn't played back on video afterwards.
Well, but it immediately went into print, and the text was read and available. But a lot of people would have got it. He certainly read it well. He was a great deliverer of speeches. We tend to forget that. He had a high tenor voice that carried very well outdoors. And he had wonderful timing. He was a great storyteller, so he always knew how to reach the punchline. He loved to read Shakespeare out loud, Shakespearean speeches, and other speeches for that matter. Reading speeches was his principal reading. He loved the word, and he loved the spoken word. So I think it would have been understood basically by people, but there's always more. I'm still understanding it more and more as I read it. But you talk about current speeches, that kind of the ability to refer somewhat subtly, as you say, is a little hard in the modern world. Probably one of the last bastions of that is church oratory, because there is a common stock of biblical knowledge or phrases, so that I suppose the last great speech delivered in this country was Dr. King's at the March on Washington.
The I Have a Dream speech.
Yes. Which begins, by the way, 50 years ago. It picks right up from the Declaration, from the Gettysburg Address. He goes back to that.
Looking back over the past few presidents, is there anyone who you would call a great speechmaker? But I'm thinking, even if you did, you'd be talking about the way they delivered somebody else's lines, because virtually no politicians write their own speeches anymore.
That's true. On the other hand, we shouldn't assume that you cannot be a great president unless you write your own speeches. Franklin Roosevelt didn't write his own speeches.
You mean a great president or a great orator?
Well, even he was a fairly good orator, too. George Washington didn't write his own speeches. So you can have Ronald Reagan delivered the texts that were given to him well. He was a practiced orator. So I don't think the secret is that you have to write your own speeches. Roosevelt didn't write the first inaugural address, for instance, which certainly had an impact on the nation.
Oh, but I know when I was growing up and I found out that there were speechwriters, I felt really cheated. I thought, well, I was under the impression that these guys were speaking from their heart, and they'd sat down and they'd struggle through what they wanted to say and what words they wanted to use, and we were witnessing the results of that. And then I realized, no, that, you know, someone's on salary to do this kind of thing, and then they read it either, you know, the president or the candidate reads it either well or poorly, you know?
Yes, but I don't think that you should judge an oration simply in terms of that. You're arguing as if there's something inauthentic, that it's not their own words. That's the same kind of argument that makes people want Lincoln to have improvised or to have written at the last minute. They think that the more spontaneous it is, the more sincere it is, the more authentic, and that if it's worked out, if you've put in elbow grease and midnight oil and that kind of thing, that it's somehow not as authentic, it's phony, it's more distant. Lincoln certainly didn't think that. He wrote all of his speeches very slowly, and his law partner Herndon said that he did the same with his law briefs. He was a slow, careful composer. He was not spontaneous, and in fact, as president, he refused constantly to give speeches when he was called on the spur of the moment. He said, my words are too important.
I wonder if you think that in their own way speeches are becoming obsolete, especially now that candidates are talking more in an interview context. And with mass media functioning the way they do, you don't need to make a speech at a pulpit for a lot of people to be able to hear you, you know, or at a platform.
Well, certainly the ease of communication through television has made it harder to give a formal speech. You know, it was a shock to many people when Roosevelt came into their homes with the so-called fireside addresses. Actually, they were quite stilted, too, if we go back and look at them. But people had not been used to having a president speak in their home. They had normally seen him in newsreels or at the theater or something of that sort. We certainly have got a more relaxed, more informal style for day-to-day use. On the other hand, people do want major speeches, and they feel disappointed when people don't come up to them. And when a good speech comes along, like that of Cuomo to the Democratic convention, or Dr. King's, or some of Jesse Jackson's, they still work. People obviously find in them something that they don't find simply in a give-and-take talk show. So I don't... They'll never be obsolete, after all. There are big occasions in our life in which we want a big celebration or a statement of big ideals, whether it's funerals or weddings sometimes or the launching of new endeavors of whatever sort. For those things, we want a larger human statement, and we feel disappointed when it's not there.
Gary Wills recorded in 1992 after the publication of his book Lincoln at Gettysburg. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, a president who both liberals and conservatives claim is their inspiration. We talk with Joseph Ellis about his character study of Thomas Jefferson, which won a National Book Award. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this President's Day, we're going to hear from the author of a character study of Thomas Jefferson. He was our third president and the author of the Declaration of Independence. Joseph Ellis won a National Book Award last year for his book about Jefferson called American Sphinx. There's so much contemporary interest in Jefferson that Ellis has named the phenomenon the Jefferson Surge. Two examples are the PBS series on Jefferson last winter, for which Ellis was a consultant, and the more recent programs on Lewis and Clark, whose expedition was launched by Jefferson. Ellis's biography tries to define and understand the many contradictions embodied by the man who wrote the Declaration of Independence yet held slaves. Jefferson's ideas define the central themes in the story of the emerging American Republic, says Ellis, and that's why he wrote the book.
Well, he does, his life has a natural span from 1743 to 1826, so he's a young man coming of age in the Revolution and then old enough to be a member of the first government of the United States and a Secretary of State, first Secretary of State, and then President, and then lives on until 1826 and dies almost providentially on July 4th, 1826, the 50th anniversary to the day of the publication of the Declaration. So his life straddles this crucial moment in American history. But apart from sheer chronology and timing, I think that Jefferson is the most potent symbol of the central paradox of American history. He wrote what we might call the magic words of American history, the ones that begin, "We hold these truths to be self-evident," which are the core of the liberal tradition and the wellspring for most of the reform movements, the end of slavery, the civil rights movement, feminism, and yet he simultaneously owned 200 slaves throughout his life, or about 200 slaves at any one time, he lived the contradiction that is, in some sense, the central contradiction, if not paradox, of American history.
You mentioned, of course, the Declaration of Independence. The first draft of his words for that, or at least an earlier draft, shows, you say, that his vision was not just political, it was also spiritual. Can you recite that earlier draft?
Yes, I think I can. He says, "We hold these truths not to be self-evident." Probably the term self-evident was added or changed by Benjamin Franklin. We're not certain about that, but the original Jefferson draft was, "We hold these truths to be sacred and undeniable." Calling on God and calling on the spiritual forces above to bless this attempted independence. And it's an interesting choice of words, because Jefferson is not a deeply religious person himself, but he does make of the American commitment to independence, in effect, a religious act. And those magic words are the closest thing to an American creed that we have, and they really are the the core catechism of American patriotism, and he did write them.
But he, or at least somebody, took out the word sacred, as in we hold these truths to be sacred and undeniable. Do you know why the word sacred was taken out?
I think that Franklin, if it were Franklin that made the change, believed that self-evident is a more secular term and that this was a secular document. It was to be presented before a political body, the Continental Congress.
And it's funny because Jefferson is the person, isn't he, who puts the separation of church and state into, you know, America's creed.
He does. I mean, I think with a very heavy assist from James Madison, his loyal acolyte, if you will. But Jefferson is the person who really is instrumental for establishing in Virginia, first of all, not in the United States as a whole, the principle that there should be a complete and total separation, what later on he will call a wall of separation between church and state. And it's one Jeffersonian principle that translates pretty directly into contemporary late 20th century American life. I mean, I think that most everything else has changed so much that it's difficult to make any kind of judgments, but that's an absolute principle on Jefferson's side, and he came up with it in the late 1770s and 1780s.
Now, you describe the Declaration of Independence as a recipe for anarchy. In what sense?
Well, if you read the Declaration, and it's tough to read it now without being caught up in the melodic tones, and it's like listening to an old record. It's almost you can't hear the words because you've heard them so many times before. But the Declaration is not a document that talks about the ways in which government can do anything positive and good. It is a discussion of all the ways in which government is oppressive and bad. It is an attempt, it is a propagandistic attempt in some sense, to destroy any credibility for the English monarch and for Parliament, and therefore it is a total assault on political power. Unlike the Constitution, which is an attempt to structure the use of political power, the Declaration is all about rights and not about any responsibilities.
Now, you say that the genius of Jefferson's rhetoric was to articulate irreconcilable human urges at such an abstract level that it masked the mutual exclusiveness of some of these urges. Does that apply to the Declaration of Independence?
I think very much so. I mean, if you go to a reading of the Declaration, and or if you go to the Jefferson Memorial on the title basin, and you watch people read and sort of move their mouths as they read those magic words, "We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal," people of fundamentally different political convictions, representing very different ideological groups and constituencies, really believe these words to mean pretty much what they want. So pro-lifers and pro-choicers think that it speaks directly to them. People that are pro and anti-gun control both think that they have Jefferson on their side. I mean, it keeps going on. Herbert Hoover and Franklin Roosevelt both thought that Jefferson agreed with them on the question of the Great Depression. Ronald Reagan and William Jefferson Clinton both claim Jefferson as a heir to their political tradition. So that part of Jefferson's genius, as I guess I've tried to suggest, is to create language that levitates above a debate. It's almost like one of those dirigibles at the Super Bowl that flashes inspirational messages to both sides. And he is a genius. I mean, in some sense, he's the rhetorician of American democracy.
When Jefferson says in the Declaration of Independence that all men are created equal, does he mean all white males?
In some sense, yes. In some sense, no. He means that all men are created equal in the sense that all human beings, black or white, male or female, as human beings, possess some core of humanity, what you might call it a soul, you might call it a moral sense, which makes them human and which cannot be violated. And in that sense, the statement is a clear statement against the institution of slavery. But Jefferson did not believe that blacks and whites were naturally equal or even biologically equal, nor did he believe that women and men were equal in their capacities. They were only equal in the fundamental sense of being human.
My guest is Joseph Ellis, author of American Sphinx, a character study of Thomas Jefferson. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Joseph Ellis, author of a character study of Thomas Jefferson called American Sphinx. Jefferson was a contradictory figure, and you seem to be particularly interested in his contradictions. I guess one of the more obvious ones is that, you know, he writes in the Declaration that all men are created equal, yet he's a slaveholder. Mm. Tell me more about how you think his views on slavery were contradictory.
Well, they were certainly contradictory in the sense that the Declaration of Independence and many other statements, of course, that Jefferson made, and the principles on which the Revolution was based were both logically and politically incompatible with the enslavement of other human beings. Jefferson understood that. That was not a pro- I mean, there's no mystery, there's no uncertainty about that. Jefferson recognized that the very principles he was declaring to be the principles of the new nation were not compatible, morally, logically, or any other way, with the continued existence of slavery. Yet he was himself trapped in it, owning about 200 slaves, and the nation itself was trapped in it. And in his early years, as a young man and as a young revolutionary, and up through the early 1780s, I think Jefferson did as much as one could reasonably expect to try to put slavery on the road to extinction. He calls for the end of the slave trade. He calls later on for a rule that prohibits the expansion of slavery into any of the new Western territories. So as a young man, I think his credentials as a progressive thinker on this are pretty impressive. But by the 1780s, he stops, and then by the 1790s and into his presidency, he's become a person who believes that we really can't do anything about it, a procrastinator, a person who argues we need to pass this along to the next generation. And then at the end of his life, he actually advocates the spreading of slavery into the Western territories, a repudiation of his earlier view. So that's the contradiction is that he continues to live with the ideal that he has propagated in 1776, while all around him are slaves. And he could walk down Mulberry Row at Monticello, where a group of slaves lived, sort of humming patriotic liberal songs, and not feel any real contradiction between the slaves around him and the ideals that he was referring to. That's one of his great secrets. It's not necessarily an attractive secret, but there seemed to be different compartments inside Jefferson, different persona that floated about and did not really speak to each other.
Well, he relied on slave labor because he was so deep in debt.
Well, he relied on slave labor in part because he was in debt, and there was the slave labor that in part made him more in debt. He certainly relied for slave labor for the construction of Monticello, for the working of his plantations in and around Monticello. He had another set of plantations down in Bedford, about 90 miles away. His own lifestyle, if we can use that word, was dependent on a level of luxury that slave labor made possible for him. The wine bill for his time as president of the United States, for example, was almost as large as his total salary as a president, so that he was accustomed to living at a pretty high level, and slavery was one of the things that made that possible. The debt he inherited from his father-in-law when he married his wife Martha compounded, and he then compounded it further by his own lifestyle, so that when he died in 1826, he was the rough modern equivalent of about $10 million in debt. And one of the reasons he couldn't free the vast bulk of his slaves and didn't is because they were part of his estate, and in that sense he really didn't own them anymore, and that he was prohibited from selling them or from freeing them.
You say that he believed that slavery was morally wrong.
So how does he hold slaves if he believes that slavery is morally wrong?
Boy, that's the great mystery of American history and of Thomas Jefferson. I think that the way he resolves that problem in his own mind is to say that eventually slavery is a doomed institution in America. And until the day comes when it officially ends, that his responsibility is to be a benevolent patriarch, a good master, and to take care of these slaves, this African-American charges, as if they were his children. And that in Jefferson's mind, and this might be, you know, distasteful to a lot of people, he believed that his highest calling was to serve as a kind of white father figure for his black charges, and that his highest responsibility was to maintain his status as a plantation owner with slaves until the day arrived when emancipation was truly possible. Of course, the day never arrived during his lifetime.
He didn't live to see the end of slavery, but if he had, he probably still would not have supported equal rights for African Americans and whites. You say that he believed in racial segregation.
He did. He really, one of the reasons that he found it so difficult to come up with a workable plan to end slavery, apart from the fact that the planters would need to be compensated, and that would be a huge amount of money and create a huge national debt, was that he did not believe that the slaves, once freed, could continue to live in the same place as the whites. And he believed that all freed slaves would have to be returned either to Africa or to someplace in the Caribbean. Some suggested west of the Mississippi, but he said no, that wasn't really feasible. That was going to be reserved for the Native Americans. But Jefferson did not believe in a biracial society. For that matter, not many other people did at that time either. He was not that unusual. He was unusual for Jefferson in articulating this as specifically and as clearly as he did.
One of the still unsettled controversies surrounding Jefferson's life is whether he had an affair with one of his slaves, Sally Hemings, an affair that produced, was it one or several children?
Four alleged children that survived.
Yeah, and do you think we'll ever really know for sure?
Well, until fairly recently, I thought we would never know. And I think that the fair way to put it, as I understand the evidence at least, is the evidence here is evenly divided. Within scholarly conversations for a long time, people would argue the evidence is overwhelming that he was not the father of Sally Hemings' children and there was no sexual relation. And then only a minority would argue the other way. A book by a woman called Fawn Brody in the 1970s began to break through that. I think that if you look at the evidence carefully, you'll see that there's evidence on both sides here, that if Jefferson were to sue in civil court, I don't think he could win, although I don't think the defenders of Sally Hemings, if that were the family suing, would win either. It's a really tough call. Anybody that claims to have a clear and unambiguous answer to the question of Jefferson and Sally Hemings is a fool or a liar. That said, DNA testings are currently underway.
Jefferson has become a model for politicians today who want to have as little government as possible. Particularly the conservatives of today who have been arguing to restrict the role of government in every way. Jefferson wrote, "The trouble with most Europeans was that they had been bred to prefer a government which can be felt, a government of energy. God send that our country may never have a government which it can feel." So he really longed for a world where government had virtually disappeared. What did he want from government? I mean, this is a president of the United States we're talking about. It's not like he just wanted to be left alone in the woods.
Well, in some ways, he really did want to be left alone. I mean, he himself did, but he also believed that the people ought to be left alone. He really didn't think that the arm of government ought to touch them on the shoulder. Usually when it did, it was out to get money, he felt. I think that the right-wing Republicans of today, if we can use that term, like Newt Gingrich and their columnist Rush Limbaugh, have a legitimate claim on Jefferson's legacy because they're not the only people that have a claim, but it is a truth that Jefferson's fundamental political enemy was government, and especially the federal government. When Jefferson saw government, he wanted it to either eliminate it or to limit it, to abate its power. While most of the other members of the revolutionary generation were trying to figure out how to use political power, how to structure it, how to discipline it, how to check and balance it. Jefferson was interested in finding a way to eliminate it. And he's the first American president, and certainly not the last, to run for the presidency on the grounds that he opposed the federal government he was about to head. And we do that quite a bit these days in the 20th century. So I think that the conservative Republicans have a legitimate claim, even though Franklin Delano Roosevelt and the liberal Democrats of the 20th century are the ones who most frequently claim Jefferson as the spiritual father of the Democratic Party. I think that Roosevelt's championing of an embrace of Jefferson, and it was Roosevelt who in 1943 dedicated the Jefferson Memorial, that act was one of the most inspired acts of political thievery in all of American history, because there's nothing that Jefferson would have hated more than the New Deal.
Now, the paradox here is that, you know, Jefferson is arguing for as minimal a government as is possible, but he never really knew a democracy when he started conceiving these anti-government ideas. To him, government was the king.
That's right. And, I mean, I think that Jefferson... And by the way, you're right to say that Jefferson seldom used the word democracy. He does towards the very end of his life. But when he uses it earlier, and when other people in the late 18th century use the word democracy, it's an epithet. It means no government. It means mob rule. But I think that it's perhaps proper to see Jefferson as a late 18th century Enlightenment figure who really believes that the Middle Ages and the so-called Dark Ages have bound the people up in this combination of oppression led by priests and kings. And Jefferson, like Voltaire, wanted to see the last king strangled with the entrails of the last priest. And once you eliminate those oppressive institutions and figures, once you get rid of an established church and a kind of monarchical government, then you free up the energies of the people at large, and they will govern and regulate themselves. He didn't really think about the ways in which this liberated humanity or people would then require disciplined government regulation after that. In that sense, he's very much a liberationist, a person who would also fit in not only with right-wing Republican values today, but also with sort of SDS, Port Huron statement, 60s radicals who believe in a kind of participatory democracy without any coercive power.
My guest is Joseph Ellis, author of American Sphinx, a character study of Thomas Jefferson. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Joseph Ellis, author of a character study of Thomas Jefferson called American Sphinx. I guess one of the views that really surprised me in your book was that Jefferson believed, he described this as the earth belongs always to the living generations.
Mm. It's one of his most powerful ideas. In some sense, it's an idea that suggests that if he were here now, he would say we're wasting our time by talking about him, because the core Jefferson legacy is not to believe in legacies, that every generation should be sovereign. And he writes this letter to Madison from France in 1789 making this case. The French Revolution is just being launched, and so it's a kind of extraordinarily magical moment, and he's inspired by this. Madison writes back and says, this is a very interesting and potentially brilliant idea, except that it's all wrong. The generations don't exist as sovereign units. They don't come into the world as cohorts in some kind of coherent way. There's comings and goings all the time. And if you really take Jefferson's position seriously, the whole idea of a constitution that will hold true with law for the ages and have contracts that are binding over time, all that would have to be dispensed with. There is a bit, I mean, I don't want to make any real comparisons between Jefferson and Mao, but there is in the Cultural Revolution of Mao the same kind of Jeffersonian idea that a people needs to reinvent itself every generation, every 20 to 25 years.
Jefferson was not much of a public person, and even as a public speaker, he'd speak very quietly, so only the people right near him could actually hear his speeches. But he did leave a lot of written records, say that we really know more about his decision-making process because of these written records than we do about any other president, with the exception of the ones that recently left us a lot of tapes.
It's true. I mean, Jefferson only delivered two public speeches in his entire 8 years as president, the first inaugural and the second inaugural. Other than that, as far as we know, he made no other public appearances other than his afternoon ride through Rock Creek Park. People never saw Jefferson as president. I call him the textual president. He made policy by drafting memoranda, which then were passed around to the members of the cabinet, and they edited it, or he re-edited it. So the act of making policy was the act of editing prose, which, of course, is Jefferson's great strength. The written language was his great strength. He had a weak voice. There was no magnification of voice then. They didn't have microphones, obviously. And in fact, one of the reasons he had originally been asked to write the Declaration was because he was so innocuous in the debates in the Continental Congress. He had never participated in any of the debates. John Adams claimed that he sat with him for 2 years in the Continental Congress and never heard him utter two sentences together. So he was a man who achieved his successes and worked his will through the written word rather than the conversational or the oratorical.
You do describe Jefferson as one of the dead white males who still matter.
Right.
Part of the evidence you give is that everybody's still debating Jefferson's life and philosophy.
They are. I mean, like when a historian studies a dead white male in the past, these days it's, you know, like doing an autopsy. But with Jefferson, it's like the body sits up and starts talking to you. People care about him. People have invested in him. He seems to be central to our understanding of who we are as a people, and there's strong feelings here. And it's both something that is uplifting as a writer and makes you feel like you're doing something that's got energy all around it. And on the other hand, it's daunting because, again, people seem to break down into these very strong pro and anti-Jefferson, and it's almost like a cartoon character.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about Jefferson. And congratulations on your National Book Award for the book.
Thank you for having me.
Joseph Ellis, recorded last year after he won a National Book Award for his character study of Thomas Jefferson called American Sphinx. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Roberta Shurrock, with Alan Tu, Monique Nazareth, and Tracy Tannenbaum. Research assistance from Sarah Scher. I'm Tariq Rose.